Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast, where we explore cutting-edge strategies to keep teams human-centered, drive innovation, and empower you with the tools and insights needed to help your team excel and thrive in today's changing world. Your host is Dan Groeneveld, a seasoned expert with over 20 years of experience enhancing team dynamics and innovation. Today, Dan is joined by Dr. Mary Ciani. Mary is a distinguished consultant, professor, and thought leader dedicated to helping individuals, teams, and organizations thrive. As a consultant, she's guided leaders, teams, and enterprises through complex transitions, from large-scale mergers to organizational restructuring and strategic pivots. In this episode, Dane and Mary explore why organizations continue to optimize for individuals, even though trust, performance, and problem-solving all happen at the team level. Drawing on Mary's experience in human capital consulting and mergers and acquisitions, they discuss what happens when team identity is disrupted, why transitions require both clarity and care, and how trust develops when teams stay together long enough to truly understand one another's strengths and working styles. The conversation also looks ahead, examining how collaboration tools, AI, and emerging neuroscience research reinforce what effective teams need most: shared purpose, clear decision-making, and real human connection. Rather than replacing judgment or experience, these tools create space for better thinking, better conversations, and more intentional team design, helping leaders move from meetings that stall to teams that actually move forward. So, teamwork makes the dream work, and we're here to inspire your next collaborative breakthrough. Gather your team or put on your headphones, and let's dive in together.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name is Dane Groeneveld, and today I'm joined by Mary Ciani. Mary and I have recently connected around her new book as author of The Consultant's Compass. And Mary's also a clinical associate professor in organizational consulting up at NYU. So I'm really looking forward to diving into the conversation, and welcome to the show, Mary.
Thank you, Dane. I'm glad to be here. Always fun to talk about teams.
Oh, so much fun. So tell us a little bit more about you. How did you come to be doing work in and around this practice of consulting and teamwork?
Well, it's interesting because I started out thinking I was going to be a licensed psychologist, and that would have very much meant I was working on an individual basis, doing therapy one-on-one. And as I started to get involved with folks who were teaching in the business school at the university I was at, I started to become fascinated with how organizations functioned. And a lot of the same theories and research that related to individual behavior could also be applied to behavior in organizations. So I went and I got some practical experience working in a corporation and started to see the importance of teamwork and how it was really teams that drove productivity, drove performance. Most of what happens in organizations, particularly today with the complex problems that we're faced with, require more than one person.
Yes.
So I started to get interested, particularly as I moved into leadership roles and realized that I needed to not only engage and empower and motivate individuals, but I needed to help them work as a team. Otherwise, we weren't going to accomplish our goals.
That's fascinating. And you came at that from a management consulting perspective primarily, is that correct?
Well, I would say human capital consulting.
Human capital.
So I mostly worked in human capital consulting firms, and a lot of my work had to do with mergers and acquisitions. So got to see working with my clients, teams get pulled apart and put back together again, and teams under stress. So really just became fascinated with how they operate.
Yeah, I've had the privilege to be part of a few mergers and acquisitions on both sides, buy and sell. And it is always fascinating to see these two organizations coming together and, you know, learning what works better here and what works better there. And then regardless of whether it works better or not, how it's going to be done, there's a lot of ground to cover in that integration period.
Well, and I think too, we work hard to build a sense of shared identity in teams, which is their power. And then suddenly that shared identity is torn apart. So we have to form new identities. And, you know, I think there are ways of acknowledging what the teams have accomplished in the past and celebrating that, but then also kind of quickly moving to say, okay, but now we're a new team, and how do the team leaders begin to shape that new identity?
Yeah. We actually had Art Pappas on the show recently from Bullhorn. So he's been the CEO there for 26 years, multiple acquisitions in their time. And he had a very direct approach to acquisitions. And it was something of what you've just said. Hey, you've been acquired, so celebrate, you know, that you and the team achieved this great thing. But there was also creating a space for grief, like, and now also grieve that that time and that team is behind, and we are now moving into the new. And the new was very clearly defined around behaviors of Bullhorn. Like, you're now a Bullhorn employee and team member, and this is how we team. And I actually found it quite refreshing that while there wasn't a lot of time spent to understand, well, what you do well that might carry forwards, the team got to know very quickly, well, this is how we do it here, and this is what's expected of you. So it took away some of that confusion and fear that I think so many suffer through those cycles.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we would often recommend to our clients to do what we call closing ceremonies.
Interesting. Right?
And I think there's a wonderful image in the William Bridges book on transitions that shows a trapeze artist. And what I'm hearing you say is very much reflected in that image, right? So we're not going to let go of the bar until the future bar is, like, you know, close by that we can grab onto, right? So
yeah.
So I'm not going to let go of what I'm doing and how I'm doing it and my team identity unless I understand what I'm going towards. And that image just always, I think, is so powerful in reflecting what needs to happen.
The bar is a fascinating metaphor. It makes a lot of sense to me because, and that explains where the confusion is. Like, if you're all of a sudden midair and you don't have either bar to hold on to, that's a pretty terrible place to be.
That's catastrophe.
You want to hope there's a trampoline below.
Right, some safety net anyway.
Yeah. No, that's fascinating. Well, we were talking when we first met about some of the work that you did earlier in your career around this concept of teams. And, you know, HR can be very monolithic and very focused on individuals. How do we hire individuals? How do we performance manage them? How do we career develop them? And you've been doing some research and thinking on actually building processes to develop teams, design teams, build teams. Did that come from the M&A work, or was that a separate piece of research?
No, it was before I got into doing M&A work. It came from my corporate experience, and particularly noticing, so I was working in a learning and development function, and that we would put teams together and, you know, they would go through the forming, storming, norming, and performing, and they'd get to that performing stage. And then we would disband them and put another team together to work on a different project. And it just baffled me as to why we couldn't think of a way to kind of keep that team who'd already gotten to that level of performance as a team together a little bit longer.
Yes.
And all of our processes are really designed around individual development, individual promotions, individual rewards. So I started to think about, was there a way, not for eternity, but for a period of time, where you could really capitalize on that team who had gotten to work together so well? And I had that really come home to me when I was moved into consulting and I was managing several projects, three or four projects, coincidentally, for the same client. And I had a team of junior consultants who were working with me on all of those four projects. And every day we would meet and talk about what the priorities were for that day, but they became interchangeable across projects, right? So they got to understand people's strengths and they would, you know, they could backfill each other, but we were able to accomplish so much more. And, you know, as opposed to if I had four different teams, and the team leader, it certainly made it easy. But, you know, I'll never forget one night I was getting ready to leave and I happened to notice that one of the consultants was still in her office working on something. And I offered to stay because I knew she had a bit of a commute and I didn't, and to stay and kind of work on it. And she just said to me, you know, Mary, you don't do good work at night. let me do it, and you do it tomorrow morning when, like, you pick up when I leave
off. Wow.
And I thought, like, that came out of that sense of trust, because I was her partner. But that sense of trust, but also the sense of really knowing. And, you know, a small thing that wound up being a large thing that she observed, that when I did something in the evening, maybe it wasn't my best quality.
Yeah.
And she wanted to avoid having to do rework. So I just got to see how teams, when they can stay together over time, just learn how to operate as an entity in ways that are so much more productive.
It's such a great example. And I bet most leaders out there would love to have a team member that could bring that level of honesty forward, because it serves the whole team. It's not just self-serving of the team member. We've had a number of guests come on the show and say, you know, one of the biggest challenges most leaders have right now is this volume control knob that, you know, the feedback just doesn't come up in the organization. So they're kind of operating with limited information at times. So I think that's super powerful.
Yeah, I mean, it speaks to what Amy Edmondson talks about, right, in terms of psychological safety.
Yeah.
And being able to have that kind of honest conversation with each other.
Yeah. I love Amy Edmondson's work. I think psychological safety has possibly been turned into a bit of a checkbox for a lot of teams and organizations right now. You know, if we finish the meeting by asking, is there anything anyone disagrees with, then we've created a psychologically safe environment. So there's a challenge there. And what I love from your story is that you brought a team together to work across multiple projects together and know each other and appreciate each other for how you work. And that's actually what builds it.
Well, and that takes, you know, spending time together. I tell a story in my book about how, I love to cook for people. So I started having my team when I was leading the M&A practice. Start having my team to my house for dinner once or twice a year, particularly when the global people who lived outside of the U.S. were going to be in town. But the other thing, and again, it was someone, a more junior consultant, who would come to me and would start to see the team bond fraying. And he would say, I think we need to come to your house for dinner. You know, I think it's time to come to your house for dinner, because, we didn't talk about work. You know, we might have talked about, you know, one time we shared what was your worst hotel experience.
Yes.
I know I'm busy with travel. But it just created that bond of people spending time together. And I think the storytelling too aspect, people just start to connect. So I think there's that ways of building that that don't necessarily have to happen in the workplace, but that whole concept of spending time together just really builds and strengthen those bonds.
Yeah, I think that's it's a particularly challenging thing to recreate now in the world that we live in that is so global. But I love that in your example, it's like when the team is in town, let's make time to go and do not just the work stuff.
And they knew they were going to get good food and good wine.
Yeah,
so I think
that always helps. It's amazing, like, no matter how many smart people there are in the room, that humans are still creatures that love to gather, eat together, and share stories. Like, it's as simple as that so often.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said for liking each other, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. That's neat. So pre-show, we were talking, Mary, on your book, so The Consultant's Compass. I've started reading it, and I'm loving that you've built it around sort of your own story and the story of others in the consulting world. What was it that took you in that direction of writing the book?
Yeah, well, again, I think it's the power of storytelling. When I started teaching at NYU, I knew that I could teach pretty easily the process of consulting, what you might think of as the science, like how do you go through the steps from diagnostics to data analysis, et cetera. But I was challenged in terms of thinking about how do I help students understand the experience of being a consultant. And you know this from your own work, it's not always a friendly experience. Test us when we don't, you know, we don't know what to do, or things that we're doing aren't working, or we have a particularly challenging client, and it's easy to question ourselves and also think that we're the only ones going through that experience.
Mm.
So I wanted to share my story, but I also wanted to really stress the point that even very seasoned, accomplished consultants have had those periods in their life, have had that learning experience, have had times even after a lot of success when they questioned whether they were good enough. But they got, and how to get out of that, right? It's not just swirling around that, but then what are the things that happen that can get you out of it? So I wanted to share those experiences, and I'm blessed with having a very strong network of wonderful consultant friends who were willing to spend the time and share their stories. And I was fascinated by the vulnerability that they allow themselves to have and really thinking about those mistakes.
The profession right now is coming under a lot of questions of like, how sustainable is it in its current format because of, you know, the advance of AI. You mentioned diagnostics and you mentioned, you know, the data analysis. So if AI can do a lot of that grunt work, you know, coming back to some of those experiences that you share in the book where you really build connection and understanding and things that the diagnostic and the data doesn't always find, seems to be like it's going to be the currency of the future, perhaps.
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, I think there's certainly things that we do as consultants where a lot of our reputational capital, for example, rested on compensation data or information that we had.
Yeah.
But I think it also rests on the experience we bring of working with other companies, working with other clients, seeing things from a variety of perspectives. Yeah. That AI can't replace. And also so many times part of our role as consultants is to put a bit of a coaching hat on, right? In helping helping our clients deal with their own challenges of how to be persuasive in the organization, for example, how to collaborate, how to engage stakeholders. AI can give you a plan for that, but it can't help you really think through in a thoughtful way how you're yourself were going to do it as a client. And I think that's where the consulting comes in and where the, you know, I talk about in my book, the need for compassion is just helping our clients understand when you're dealing particularly in M&A situations that they're not always easy decisions that you're executing or that you're making, but and having someone help you see what's around the corner and what's going to happen because you've been there based on experience.
Yeah.
So the really strategic consulting, I think the complexity of consulting, what AI allows us to do is have more time to do that.
Yeah, I really like the way you framed that. And coaching is interesting. We're seeing more and more recognition of the need to have coaches. And there's some great organizations that are building internal coaching capacity. But what you touched on there intrigues me, which is sometimes having a coach that brings those external outside influences. You know, this is how other industries have tackled it, or I've seen similar moments to this in different cultures. That's very hard to replicate either through AI or just your own team.
And it's really the reason why our program at NYU is both executive coaching and organizational consulting.
Yeah.
Because we see them as roles, being a coach or being a consultant, but we also see them as competencies, right, that really feed into each other.
That's neat. So also pre-show, we were talking, Mary, about what excites you about teams now. You've seen some really cool changes both in, you know, the organizational landscape, the social landscape, lots has gone on over the last 10, 20 years. But now you mentioned to me, we've always known certain things about teams, but we seem right now to have, you know, the platform to actually be able to go out and execute on what we know. So maybe you could expand a little bit more on, you know, the what we've knowns and the what allows us to be out there actually deploying some of that.
Well, we've always known it's important to have, you know, a variety of voices in the room for discussion. And I think about how we used to be in a conference room and there would be this AT&T pod in the middle with voices coming through. And sometimes I would remember to put name tags near that pod. So we had a ritual reminder that there were people there
in the room,
but it never felt like you were in the room, right? Yeah. Even though we might say, well, what do you think, right? You were just missing, you know, why is somebody laughing, or, you know, what's the murmuring that's happening? It wasn't the same experience. And I think now with some of the collaboration tools that we have with Zoom or other Teams or whatever platform that you use, but also, you know, Google Docs. I mean, I just remember the frustration working on a consulting team project with version control, right? So all of those things that made it's like, oh, it's just easier to do it myself, you know, are slowly going away through tools and technology that allow us to be more effective, even when we're not all in the room, which most times we're not these days. So I think that's a real plus if we learn how to use those tools effectively and to really focus on how they support collaboration. I think that could be really, really important. And, you know, you mentioned AI earlier, and I think that's, if we think about AI as another tool, just the ability to not to have need a note taker, right? You can have taking notes and not having some person, you know, did you catch that? Or, you know, it allows you to focus on the conversation you're having, not on the capturing of what you're talking about. So I think all of those things help to enable teams to really focus on the conversation, to focus on the decision making, giving the team more time to hear different points of view in a way that we really couldn't do before.
I like that. And decision making, strangely, like it's often spoken about in organizational development, but often in the HR field, it's not getting a lot of time and attention because we're thinking about compliance and we're thinking about optimizing for the individuals. But decision-making is a really important element of teamwork and just organizational clarity in general.
Yeah, and I think how decisions get made really frame the focus of the team. Does the team have the authority to actually make a decision, or are they just an input? Are they just, you know, coming up with recommendations? And that's where I think a team leader or a leader in general just needs to be clear with there's not one modality of being a team for this particular situation. What do I need this team to do?
Yes.
And being clearer about that so that there's a sense of direction. I mean, I think we've all been in meetings, right? When we think we're operating as a team, we leave and nothing happens. Nobody knows who's accountable. Nobody's taken any action. Like no decision has been made. And then we start to think, well, that was a waste of time. Like, why do I want to go to these team meetings? Because there's never any clear outcome or output that happens.
That one's huge. One of my mentors always says that teams can't do work. Individuals do work on teams. And I'm always kind of sat there and been, I'm a teamwork guy. Like, of course, teams do great work. But actually, when you break down the work, to your point, the context, the purpose, the decision-making, the resources is defined by the team, but then the individuals go off and do it. Even per your early example, if they're passing it off to each other, but there's individual work that happens on the team.
Right, and I have to know what you want me to do, right?
Yeah, yeah.
What you're going to do, yeah.
Yeah, I think I saw another great post the other day, which was, just because we come out of a meeting having made a decision doesn't mean that the work's going to happen. So that next step. So I've always liked that model of, while we're still here, let's at least design the first 15% of how we're going to turn that decision into reality, even if we don't have all of the constituent parts.
Yeah, and we all love brainstorming, right? And ideating and all of that and you know, debating things back and forth, but then it's like, okay, now what?
Yeah.
And that's the piece that gets missed.
Absolutely. And on neuroscience, so when you get these collaboration tools and AI coming together, you also mentioned that there's emerging research coming from the field of neuroscience that kind of reinforces a lot of what we've known in the past to be good for teams. Would you be able to elaborate on that, Mary?
Yeah, so I think, you know, we see a lot of research that shows that teams can outperform individuals. We know that there's a lot of research that says the more diverse the team is, the more solutions, the more innovative they are. But we're also now, through brain research, kind of being able to test what happens to people's brains when they're working together. And that whole concept of synchronicity.
Yeah.
Right. So that as people are working, their brains start to mirror each other. And that just strengthens that sense of identity. And we know, so it just reinforces the fact of having shared stories. Storytelling can help to do that. Having, you know, taking time to build that sense of shared identity. Because we also see that the higher the levels in some of the research that's been done, the higher levels of synchronicity, the higher the performance.
Yes.
So it just speaks to the value of being together. And even the times, right, of I've worked with some leaders who, like, once the meeting started, it was all business, where that opening chit-chatting and just conversation and how was your weekend, like, that starts to build them. Brain, like, mirroring, right? Because we're telling stories. I did the same thing, and that increases all of that. So it just speaks to that whole thing about you can't really replace the need for that human interaction.
Yes.
And those conversations.
Yeah, the human connection and interaction is a really important one for me in the research we continue to do. There are, you know, thought leaders out there that will say, hey, if it's a sales meeting or if it's an operations meeting, you've got to come in and be really clear. You know, first impressions matter, really set out the tone for everyone. But I think at least creating space for it, even if it's, hey, we're gonna have 5 minutes of getting into the room and connecting with people before we start talking about the agenda, I find that can be very helpful.
I agree.
When you talk about synchronicity, I haven't actually covered much of that research. But I am aware of, like, some of the pitfalls of groupthink. So, like, is there a relationship there between synchronicity and groupthink? And is there anything that you've seen from your research or work that talks to, you know, how you keep an eye to the benefits of one and maybe reducing some of the impact of the other?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's always a risk, and I can't cite the research that would support that. But I think it's, again, goes back to roles and several of the things that we've talked about. I mean, even sometimes appointing someone to be the devil's advocate.
Yeah.
People don't often want to step into that role, right? So,
yeah.
Some people love it, and maybe you'd want them to do it less, right?
Yeah, so, true.
So it varies. But I think making it, giving people permission to disagree. You know, I had a situation happening in class a couple of weeks ago where at the end I said, so what would you dispute? What do you disagree with?
And I love that.
The student said, boy, thank you for making it okay to say that, right? Because particularly if you're, you know, we're all on Zoom and you're the professor and, you know, just to disagree, but to give people permission to do that, like what part of this isn't sitting well with you and making it okay?
Yeah.
So I think there's always that sense, right, of having the team identity become so tight that you don't want to create conflict. But I think it's also helping people to figure out how to have constructive conflict and making that part of your norm.
Yeah. We had a guest on the show, Craig Weber, who had some really good methodologies for bringing sort of candor into the room. And one of his, which I really liked, he would kind of say, well, once you've done the work, you know, the leader should step out and tell the team, hey, get into a group and come up with two reasons this won't work. Like, make it a mission for them to break what you've just agreed you're going to do. And the benefit of the leader stepping out is that it does create a bit of safety for people to voice hesitations, concerns that they might not want to say right in front of that leader. Or things that may upset a colleague, because sometimes you'd be like, hey, we can totally bring that product to market, but I don't think engineering's going to be able to hit the quality requirements to enter that market. You're not going to say that in front of the boss without upsetting your teammate, but you could say it, you know, across a peer group perhaps. And I always found that that's a cool approach.
Yeah, I mean, just another thing, you know, tip that I've used is to, when you're brainstorming, to number the ideas rather than saying that was Joe's idea or Mary's idea.
That's a smart tip. Yeah.
But to say, gee, idea number three, let's talk about that, right? So it kind of takes the person away from feeling that, you know, you can feel attacked when you're like, well, Gain, that was you know, there's a lot of problems with that idea versus saying, well, let's talk about three in comparison to four. Like, what do we think?
Yeah, that's a really good one. I've not heard that one, but I will put that into use because I've fallen into the other trap of like trying to acknowledge someone for bringing the idea forward. But then you might get stuck when the rest of the team's like, oh, you know, that we've just said that so-and-so's idea. I don't want to hurt so-and-so.
Or you didn't mention my idea and I said something.
Right? Also true. Yeah, playing favorite.
Appreciative, right?
So many nuances there. What's your belief then, Mary, as we go forward? It's great that NYU and we're seeing more programs evolve in this space in academic institutions, you know, tertiary institutions. But is this more work that we should be starting to see in our youth, you know, more that middle school, high school? Or, you know, I'm intrigued just thinking about that next generation coming into the workplace and, you know, being on different teams. Are we giving them some of those skills? Are you seeing anything different in students that are coming into your programs?
Yeah, not really, but you raise a good point. You know, we say that boys and girls who participate on teams, whether it's a sport team or a chess team, whatever, develop team skills. But I don't know that we're helping them understand what those skills are, right? Mm-hmm. So they have the experience. So I don't know whether, I don't think we need to debrief every student activity and turn it into an academic experience, but there should be some, whether it's through the coach or through a teacher, the advisor, helping students to see what they're learning and how it's helping them to be better. Because I don't think it's deliberate. I don't think it becomes intentional and visible. And I'm often surprised because in my classes, because I know that consulting is a team sport, how many people will say, and these are adults with, you know, 10, 20 years of experience, say that they've never really had to produce a work product as a member of a team.
Interesting.
As individual, they might be on a team,
yeah,
but they haven't actually had to collaborate for one grade.
Yeah.
Team. So we're not really, again, and it may be that we're just not creating enough visibility to what's happening and what teamwork really looks like.
That is an interesting one, just from a design of work perspective. If we're out there thinking about a new project coming up and we're getting clear on the tasks that go to each individual on the team, but does it create or invoke the need to almost do a team review of the work, or what might be a way to start bringing some of that forward so that those individuals are seeing how their work connects to the greater product versus just stands on its own?
Yeah, I did some interesting work a few years ago when I was teaching working as an independent consultant, where it was an insurance company moving from doing claims reviews from an individual to a team perspective. And my role, like I, what I did was sat in on those meetings, learned a lot about claims, but to see how they were operating, I didn't intervene, but what I would do is meet with the team leader afterwards and highlight, like, these are the behaviors that still need to change because it wasn't really, the team wasn't managing the work in the team process. They were still doing individual work and coming together. So I think there's ways of just helping teams be more effective, and whether it's through team coaching or team facilitation. And you know, I think the other thing is we almost expect when we get to the senior executive level that they all know how to operate as a team. And I think sometimes they can be as dysfunctional as any other team, right?
Oh, yeah.
Wearing their enterprise leader hat, but looking at things from their own purview.
Yeah, I would agree. I work with Ian McDonald, who did a lot of work on or continues to do work on systems leadership theory. And he looks at three core buckets of capability, like the technical, the social, and the commercial. And when you look at some executive leaders, they're very heavily indexed on the technical or the commercial, and the social they tend to outsource. Well, my team leaders will manage my people, or my salespeople will manage my customers. So often that does tend to be a bit of a chink in the armor or a blind spot for executive leaders. And when change comes upon us, that's often when you need that social capability and competence to kind of get the team grounded again on how we're going to go forward.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And, you know, the whole idea of organizations being more matrix, I was in a conversation with someone last week, and they were telling me about someone they knew who was working with a consultant to help them be more effective at working in a matrix organization. And that was another one where I said, we've been doing that for 20, 30 years when we still don't have it solved. Like, how do you solve for the white space? And it's really thinking about, it's a team, right? And how do you manage being on multiple teams with different priorities, different agendas, but that need to kind of come together in an integrated way.
And being on different teams is tough. We were doing some research and we were asking people how many teams they believe they show up in, you know, regardless of role, whether you're turning up into a committee as a team member, or you're chairing a committee as a leader, or it's a tiger team or a new project product launch. And it looks like people are participating on anywhere between 8 and 12 teams at a time. So that's a lot. It's almost like we've expanded all of those interfaces in our daily job. And going back to your early example in the show, when you've got a team that can do most of its work together across 4 or 5 projects rather than an individual that jumps onto 4 or 5 project teams, you get a higher degree of fidelity there.
Yeah, and I wonder with all of those teams, and we talk about the importance of shared identity to team performance, like how do you even have one, right?
I can't even imagine where it begins. I know personally I tend to have low energy, and in fact I find myself opting out of teams where I'm kind of a member because of my role or because of a very small piece that I bring to the team, but I'm not really tied into, you know, the team's mission or purpose. I'm just there to help. I find that really hard to show up and be engaged in those settings.
It's hard to feel like the level of commitment, right, in terms of your contribution.
Yeah.
You know, and the other thing, you know, when you're making me think about, and I don't know why I made this connection, was recognizing people's different styles. You know, when you start to talk about your own experience, like as someone who's an introvert, I sometimes needed to say, look, I just need to sit with this for a little bit by myself to get my thoughts organized before I can engage in this conversation, because I would get overwhelmed with all of the different information and trying to formulate my own perspective. So I think too, making it comfortable to say, hey, let's take a pause. Everybody sit back, you know, and recognize the different styles that people have, that, you know, I wasn't quiet because I was disengaged.
No.
I was quiet because I was trying to mentally get to myself to a place of understanding.
Yeah, that's true. And I'm the opposite of that. I'm ENFP on the Myers-Briggs. And so I like to kind of process out in the open, in the loud, and kind of build on the run. So if someone walks into a meeting and gives me a detailed plan, like here's a 120-day plan for how we're going to achieve this, I'm lost. There's no way I can start reading a plan and make any sense of it. And I just feel like stressed that I'm getting like contained into making the decisions in this Excel spreadsheet. So yeah, styles, if you're on 12 different teams, how are you even going to know how those team members best show up?
Yeah. And how you should show up, right? Because to your point, you may be, your value in being there may differ team from team to team.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's very interesting. When it does come to building identity as a team, you talked about building connection through like your dinners, for example. But are there any approaches or tools that you've seen work really well, you know, particularly in a time of transition around a merger and acquisition or a new company launch to kind of build that team identity?
Yeah, I think it goes back to just the basics of good team effectiveness, right? It's like, do we have a common goal? And really kind of spending time with that. We're doing some partnership projects with our students and organizations. And for the first time, what we did is we're building kind of a consulting boot camp to go along with that.
Nice.
And just spending some time. So last Friday, we just spent some time saying, like, what do you all want to get out of this? Because it's not a grade. It's not an academic. It's an extracurricular. Like, What do you hope to get out of this so that everybody's clear about that? So I think it's really kind of understanding why are we all here, to your earlier point. That helps to create that identity. Do we have a common goal? Do we have a common purpose? And then I think what you mentioned as well, do I understand the role that I'm playing and how I'm adding value, what my contribution is? Is it going to be meaningful? Right? Yeah. Does it matter that I show up for the meeting or not? Am I going to be missed? Right? And sometimes you're not. Sometimes they prefer that you don't show up. But other times it's like, all right, if you're not there, what's the disconnect that happens? So I think being clear about the goal, being clear about what you're expecting each person to contribute, and then celebrating the outcomes and successes, like what are those milestones along the way that just helps with that? You know, I just remember a consulting project that I was on that was fairly large and fairly intense, and there was a large client project team that I was supporting. And at the end of it, they had given my client had given each of their team members this Tiffany apple with a date on it and gave one to me. And that made me feel, again, like, so sometimes it's something symbolic. You know, I think it's on my desk and I maintain good feelings about that team that I was on because there was even that symbolic recognition that I had been a part of the team, even though I was there as an external consultant.
Yeah, and those symbols are super powerful, often more so than, you know, the party or the award or the bonus, because it's the human to human, it's the thought that kind of goes into it. And it's going back to your point on identity, if all of the team is getting this and you're being included in the team as an outsider, that's a real lift.
Yeah, I remember one of the most powerful things I did, and I don't know how I came up with this idea, but the consulting firm I was at had gone through two back-to-back mergers. So in between the first merger and the second merger, I brought my team together globally to kind of mark, to your point that we talked earlier of kind of a closing ceremony. And it happened to be around Christmas time. So I found an ornament that kind of reflected what I felt that person's contribution was. And we had a chance as a group to celebrate, but then I had a chance to kind of acknowledge each person's contribution to the team or something unique about them.
Yeah.
To giving them either, you know, to giving them this ornament that I had scoured the earth for to find, you know, 20 different ones that would have individual meaning, but again, it was that sense of we were a team, but we also contributed, and we might not be a team going forward into the newly combined organization, but we have this experience.
There's something that I love about going out and finding the individual ornaments or gifts too, because there's the team element, but I think one thing that teams can do for individuals is give them affirmation of this is the role you played, here is a capability and a story you take forwards. And I've always loved doing that, particularly with sports teams. You know, we give someone kind of a lock and a key, like a padlock. Mm-hmm. And as a rugby team member, and we say, you get the lock and key because, you know, whenever anyone was in your part of the field, you always made the tackle. You know, no one could break you. And so that person goes forward into their university career or whatever, and they're like, that's what I was known for. So it's going back to roles. It's helpful to know what your future role is, but it's also helpful to know what your past role was on the team.
Yeah, it can become a touchstone for us, right? When maybe things aren't working out, we can kind of go to that thing.
Yeah.
Say, okay, I can do this.
No, that's neat. Well, it's been a great conversation, Mary, as always. These things can fly by when we're having fun diving into topics that mean a lot to us. But I really loved when we opened up the way you bought that work. It was the flying trapeze, you know, not letting go of one bar until you've got the next bar to hold on to. And that reference to the closing ceremony when you're doing mergers and acquisitions or shifting teams material in a restructure, perhaps. I thought that was super cool. I love the way that you have a perspective on, you know, consulting and coaching becoming more intertwined, and actually in the future, even with AI, that role of being a consultant and a coach is going to be very critical to coming in and sharing those wider perspectives and helping leaders go through tough times and vulnerable moments. And as we dived into some of those tools and the AI and the neuroscience that allows us to be more intentional about landing good team design, good team identity, and shared practices, I think that's something that a lot of people now have access to without spending a crazy amount of money. Those tools are right there. I remember going back to your point on the AT&T box, we used to have to pay to rent a facility that it could actually host global teleconferences at in one of my businesses. It was an inordinate cost to do it. So it's super cool that that's there.
Thank you. And thank you for giving me a chance to plug the NYU program and my book.
You bet.
It's really fun talking with you.
No, it's great. And for anyone that wants to learn more about the NYU program or the Consultants Compass, how do they best find you and your material?
Probably best way is through LinkedIn.
Great. All right. Well, we'll make sure to share your profile when we post the show with the show notes.
Great. Thank you. Have a great rest of your day.
You too. Thanks, Mary.
Just a quick note before we go. The views and opinions shared in this episode are those of our guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the host, Dane Gruneveld, the Leader Group, our patron Huddle 3, or our partners and affiliates. Any scenarios discussed are for the purpose of fueling creative thinking and conversation and should be viewed only in this context. Dane, Leader, our sponsors, partners, and affiliates do not endorse any guest or any organization they may be associated with. It's important to remember that every workplace is as individual as the people within it. Our recommendation is to always seek solutions that are specifically designed to help serve your team's unique needs. And to this point, please know we're here, ready to help you find the best way forward, no matter where your starting point is. You can connect with Dane or myself, Alicia McCraw, on LinkedIn or via the links contained in the show notes. Thanks again for tuning in. And hey, if you think someone in your network would benefit from this episode, feel free to share it or give us a 5-star rating. Those 5 little stars really help us reach more curious people like you. We'll catch you next time on the Future of Teamwork.